Time for the Big Picture program, and we're joined on the line by AB Dowji. Welcome him to the program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
How are you this morning?
Alhamdulillah, things are always good in Durban, Mufti. I always tell you that.
Yes, it's always is better on that side, the grass greener. Unfortunately, not this time around with the drought. May Allah make it easy for one and all. What is the story that caught your eye?
But before I get to that story, let me just make a very important announcement. After carefully examining the political scene in South Africa, and after very careful consideration and deep soul searching, I have decided on a very important step, Mufti.
Yes, tell us.
Yes, dear listeners, it's a life-changing decision that I arrived at. After weighing up the pros and cons, after vigorous self-reflection and wide consultation with family and friends. And so today, I am announcing to the world and to the Ummah at large that for the good of our beloved country, this wonderful rainbow nation, I, Abu Bakr Ahmed Muhammad Dowji Kanchi Patel of Gala District 14 Surat, do hereby declare that I will be standing for elections for the Parliament of South Africa. So there you are. Breaking news. Breaking news. I am sure
shocking.
That this news is going to make headlines around the world. I'm sure that BBC, CNN, Al Jazeera are already rushing to call me for an interview. It's going to be a roller coaster ride from now till I get elected by a landslide vote. All very exciting indeed, dear listeners. So, which party will I be joining? Ha, that's the question, right? Actually, I don't think that any party is suitable for me to join. Therefore, I will be forming my own party. Yes, that's right. A brand new party, a real winner. And what will be the name of the party? Actually, I was going to announce it at a big press conference with all the world's media present. But I owe my allegiance to Radio Islam. And so, dear listeners, brace yourselves. Brace yourselves. Are you ready? The name of the new party is the Corruption Party. That's right, folks. The Corruption Party. Isn't that a wonderful name?
Absolutely.
I believe that one should be absolutely honest and truthful and transparent in politics. That is what will get you the support and confidence of the voters. Say it like it is. No ducking and diving. The Corruption Party. And our policy is very, very simple. Our motto is, vote for the Corruption Party and collect your tenders right now. Isn't that very brilliant, eh?
Absolutely.
Here's another one. Give us 1,000 rands and you will get tenders worth millions. That's very catchy. I just love it. Here's another one. Become a member of the Corruption Party and we will give you 100 freshly printed false ballots to stuff into the boxes at the polling booths. Good heavens. I'm so excited. Of course, we will be promising free water and electricity, no taxes, free housing, free education, free transport, free healthcare, free food. What will be our slogan? Everything must fall. The more I think about it, the more the idea, more ideas start popping up in my head. So, dear listeners, join now and collect your membership card. And the first 1,000 who apply for membership will be given pension cards no matter what age you are. And
wow.
If you bring in, and if you bring in 10 members, we will build a lovely fire pool at your house, the Corruption Party. And our manifesto is very clear. No need to pay back the money. Okay, now to another announcement. And still with the subject of politicians and corruption. Now, for years we have been, we've heard of top politicians and civil servants stealing millions and millions of rands of taxpayers' money. And what happens to them? Well, many of them are suspended on full pay, or they get a golden handshake and the whole thing gets hushed up. But most often the chore gets redeployed. He or she leaves one position and is given another. For example, maybe you'll get an ambassador's position in some country. What I'm getting to is that a person is caught with his fingers in the till. He stole millions, but his reputation is not tarnished at all, completely intact. He steals, but yes, his reputation is not stained. And so, dear listeners, I have come up with a nice new phrase, a new expression. And remember, you heard it first on Radio Islam. And it's copyright, so if you use it, don't forget to send a check. Here's the new expression I have just invented in the English language. In South Africa, you steal and your reputation is not stained. I call it stainless steel. How you like that, eh?
Excellent.
Stainless steel.
Stainless steel.
It captures the whole phenomenon of corruption. A fellow takes the blame for allowing the Gupta plane to land, and voila, he becomes ambassador of some European country. Stainless steel. You heard it first on Radio Islam. And still with the subject of elections and voting, and the story that caught my eye, and at this point, let me state that I hope that what happened in the next story doesn't happen to me and the corruption party. Turkey recently had elections, and Recep Tayyip Erdogan won a decisive victory. One fellow by the name of Ali Osman Demirtas formed his own party there in Turkey and began campaigning. He went everywhere to address people about his policies. The biggest crowd that he managed to attract was, how many people? Six. That's right. The biggest rally drew only six people. The total vote he received at the end was 504. But you know what? It gets worse. At one polling booth in the city of Bursa, he and his wife voted. When the votes were counted, it was found that only one person voted for Ali Osman. That means that even his wife didn't vote for him. Our Mampara said, I ran for elections to teach the political parties a lesson. I did my job. Winning or losing is not important. I like that part where he says, I ran to teach the political parties a lesson. Amazing. I'm sure that must have made Erdogan very nervous indeed.
Definitely.
No doubt about it. Ladies and gentlemen, Ali Osman Demirtas is the Ulu of the week. But of course, I'm not nervous about the corruption party. I can just see millions pitching up to vote as I hand out false ID cards and cancel their traffic fines.
Yes, we need those types of policies. We move on to Palestine. What's the latest on that side?
Well, it's a very serious subject, that, of course. And I was reading through the Mercury, that is our morning newspaper here, just the other day, and came across a book review. I found it very interesting. It was entitled Selling Apartheid, Israel's Global Propaganda War. Now, as listeners will know from last week, my laptop is still on life support, and I'm eagerly waiting for a secret admirer to send me a 14-inch MacBook Air. I will therefore spend this time, because the laptop is in deep recession, that not much information can be gathered. And therefore, I will read some extracts from this article, the book review. Here is what it says. As I told you, the headline is Selling Apartheid, Israel's Global Propaganda War. The Israeli government was acutely aware that its policy of apartheid was winning it few friends internationally. A propaganda campaign was devised to counter the negative media and growing isolation of the country. As early as 1948, the newly elected Likud government recognized that the U.S. was a critical ally. Every subsequent prime minister or president would also hold that view. The result was that a vast sum of money was spent in a relentless campaign to retain American support in the face of Israel's worsening reputation. The results were mixed. With millions of rands at its disposal, Washington lobbying firms were hired, contribution made to the campaigns of U.S. senators and congressmen, and fact-finding trips arranged to Israel. One of the most cynical aspects of the government's lobbying was the use of black lobbyists, church leaders, and anti-communist black conservatives to sell the case for Israel. One opponent expressed his shock at seeing a black American lobbying for the Israeli government. Ultimately, the campaigns were ineffectual. At best, they bought the government time, but could not halt the inevitable. Well, there you are. So, dear listeners, that's a book review, Selling Apartheid.
Yes.
Right, Selling Apartheid, Israel's Global Propaganda War. But let me confess to something. I was not completely truthful with you. This book review is not about, or the book itself is not about Israel. It's about South Africa. The title actually is Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. It covered the time when Minister of Information Connie Mulder started the Citizen newspaper, and the very smart character Eshel Rudy went about spending millions of rands trying to improve South Africa's image here and overseas. Some of you old topies may remember that episode. The reason I replaced the name South Africa with Israel is that there are such close parallels between how Israel is struggling to paint a positive image of itself on the world stage and how apartheid South Africa attempted to do the very same thing. In the end, it all failed, came to nothing. The new expression that is frequently used is putting lipstick on a pig.
Mm.
And now to another story. As I said before, it is easier to criticize Israel inside Israel than it is outside of the country. That's right. You know, I read the Israeli newspapers every day on the internet, especially the Haaretz newspaper, which is described as being a leftist newspaper. And it often carries articles very critical of Israeli policy. Two people, both of them Israelis and both Jewish, who speak truth to power are Gideon Levy and Amira Haas. Very brave and very outspoken indeed. Telling things that Israelis don't hear or don't want to know. And therefore, they get, these two people get criticized very strongly and even attacked. But of course, they don't back down. No siree. Amira Haas was down here a few weeks ago, I think, and she had to rush back home because of the volatile situation there. I just came across an article yesterday that she wrote that took my breath away. Really, it did. And I'm going to read the whole thing to you. No laptop means no other information to analyze. So, listen carefully. From the Haaretz newspaper by Amira Haas. She says here, Israeli soldiers have gotten used to feeling heroic in their planes, tanks, and armored jeeps. But now they are dying of fear as vengefulness erupts. When it comes to bravery and daring, the young Palestinian demonstrators are defeating the Israeli soldiers and border police. They are armed with agility and speed and kafirs covering their faces. They are armed with stones and Molotov cocktails, while the soldiers behind their military exercises are armed with and protected by armored vehicles, drones, helmets, deadly weapons of various types, and poisonous tear gas. Against the bravery of the young Palestinians, the cowardice of the Israeli soldiers is exposed. They have gotten used to feeling strong and heroic in their planes, tanks, and armored jeeps, in the detention and interrogation rooms and observation towers with sophisticated equipment, in their late-night break-ins into houses and their pulling minors from their beds. Facing the kafir stone, and Molotov cocktail, they are lost, insulted, then vengefulness erupts. You, Israeli reader, should liberate yourself a bit from the Israeli media diet, that makes the situation so shallow. You should liberate yourself from the language of the masters of civil disorders and riots. Instead, watch the uncensored clips from the battlefield. Soldiers in jeeps running over protesters. A soldier spraying tear gas from point-blank range in the eyes of medics who come to evacuate the wounded. Soldiers setting on a store owner who brings in his wares while clashes are going on, and the soldiers kick him in an orgy of sadism. The violent cowardice of Israeli soldiers comes on the orders of the higher-ups, military and political. It's part of obligatory service in an army whose main role is to defend the colonialist expansion. The bravery and daring of the Palestinians is against their will, forced on them as foreign rule has been forced on them. This courage is passed on by osmosis from generation to generation for as long as the reasons behind them, behind these traits, have not been removed. And the adults look on in amazement at the young people. They have nearly forgotten they were once like them. No top officer or political leader, no emergency reserve call-up order can force the Palestinians to go out to the military checkpoints and separation barriers in the villages trying to preserve the tradition of the populist struggle for more than a decade and cultivate the bravery and daring. If the unpopular Palestinian leaders have done something smart, it's their order that armed Palestinians should not be allowed to come close to the protest sites. The Palestinian demonstrators know they could be killed, arrested, tortured, or put on a degrading show trial, but they are armed with justice. We won't say thank you that the soldiers in the West Bank are not spraying the protesters with live bullets and killing 10 at once, as they killed the protesters in Gaza. We can assume they received orders to try not to kill demonstrators. It turns out that when the army wants to, it can operate without killing. Does this mean the soldiers and police received orders to kill anyone a few meters from them suspected of possessing a knife, including a yeshiva student whom they mistake for an Arab? True, in contrast to the bravery and daring of the many protesters, is the desperation of others. Without orders from above, they run to their deaths waving a knife, because in such a situation it's clear the Israeli soldiers are dying of fear and their cowardice is deadly. Deadly by order, because what is it to riddle a person with bullets who's already lying wounded on the ground, if not cowardice, murderousness, carrying out an order, or all of them together? Journalist Mohammed Daragme published a courageous article that speaks to the hearts of many and angers others. The title of his article, "Don't Go Out to Die, Palestine Needs You Alive." Daragme calls on the young people, as he says, he tells his own children, not to let the despair and emotion of revenge cause them to lose their heads and lives. The politicians, he writes, fear losing their popularity, so they don't dare come out publicly against the knife attacks. He calls on the intellectuals not to remain silent and not to fear. They should shout out against this contagious, suicidal phenomenon and bring it to an end. He calls on all Palestinian leaders from the extreme right to the extreme left to say enough is enough, seize the opportunity, and channel the national anger towards mass protest against the occupation. Protest without death. Protest that is all about life, revolution, hope, and change. The world, he writes, does not accept the knifing and car ramming attacks on civilians, just as it opposed the so-called martyr operations, the suicide attacks. He continues, it is said, did the non-violent struggle bring an end to the occupation? And I will say, has the armed and military struggle done this? Our cause is not local but international. The world has created the problem, and it is the one that will find the exit, but it will not do so if we keep silent about the occupation, and it will not do so if we commit suicide. It will only do so if we preserve the human part of our national struggle. And we should add, the humanity and courage of those fighting for freedom stand out against the cowardice and lack of humanity of those who have stolen it. Well, there you are. Powerful stuff indeed. Amir Ahas.
Yes.
Saying it like it is. No punches pulled. I like the line, the one line in that article. The world has created the problem, and it is the one that will find the exit. And on that note, dear listeners, I want to draw your attention to two acts of treachery in the history of Palestine that happened in the month of November. Never forget these dates. Let me read to you from Wikipedia. From Wikipedia.
Yes.
It says here, the Balfour Declaration dated 2nd November 1917 was a letter from the United Kingdom's Foreign Secretary, Arthur James Balfour, to Walter Rothschild, 2nd Baron Rothschild, a leader of the British Jewish community, for transmission to the Zionist Federation of Great Britain and Ireland. And it stated, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Amazing stuff there. Dear listeners, at that time, November 1917, Britain did not control Palestine. It was under the Ottoman Empire. But as one prominent writer, Arthur Koestler, stated, one nation solemnly promised to a second nation the country of a third. So do something useful, dear listeners. Google the word Balfour Declaration today and read about this shameful episode in Palestine's history. Something else shameful also happened in November. It was known as the UN Partition Plan. On the 29th of November 1947, the United Nations, made up of 33 members, decided that Palestine should be divided up between the Jews, or as they were called then, the Zionists, most of whom had arrived over the past 20 years from Europe, should be divided between them and the Palestinians who were living there for centuries. The Jews at that time numbered 600,000, the Palestinians numbered 1.3 million. The UN, with enormous pressure from U.S. President Harry Truman, his government put pressure on the member states of the United Nations, and the UN decided in its wisdom to give 54% of Palestine to the Jews. Of course, the whole issue was voted in the General Assembly and therefore had no real effect, and was, in the following 6 months, abandoned by both sides. Fighting intensified, and by May 1948, the Zionist forces captured 78% of Palestine and declared it as the State of Israel. So, dear listeners, please remember these two dates. 2nd of November 1917, the Balfour Declaration, and 29th of November 1947, the UN Partition Plan. Two very dark days in the history of Palestine.
Yes, in the history of mankind, undoubtedly. Now, light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, I read these words of wisdom just this morning in the Mercury newspaper. Charles Dickens said, there is nothing better than a friend. There is nothing better than a friend, unless it's a friend with chocolates. And I read something else also that is very accurate. A fanatic is a person who cannot change his mind and won't change the subject. So you must have come across such people. A fanatic is a person who cannot change his mind and won't change the subject. He just goes on and on and on about the issue that he's feeling very strongly about. I like that one. And of course, if you're looking for fanatics, you will easily find them amongst football supporters. You know, if you get caught up in one of their discussions, then you know exactly what I mean. And nothing must get in the way when they are watching their team on TV. Listen to what I read in the paper here, which I have in front of me. It says here, a woman told an English divorce court, my husband asked me if I had anything to discuss with him before the football season started. Can you believe that? Which reminds me of what Ronnie said to Gulambai, they're both from Mirbank. He said, boss, you know what happened? And Gulambai said, what happened? And Ronnie replied, my wife was putting on her makeup and she asked me to pass her the lipstick. And you know what happened, Gulu? By mistake, I passed her the super glue. Now she stopped talking to me. And here's another one, Mufti. Sometimes, you know what? Children speak the truth, and it be quite, and it's quite startling also. What's that expression? Out of the mouth of babes or something like that. Anyway, 6-year-old Sumaya was pointing to a book on the shelf there. And of course it was the Quran. And she said, Mummy, what is that? And Mummy replied, that is Allah's book. And Sumaya said, better give it back to him because no one around here reads it. How's that, eh?
Yeah.
Soot out of the mouth of babies. Final one, Maulana. Final one.
Go ahead.
The Maulana here in Isipingo, early in the morning, went outside his flat, which is attached to the masjid, and he found a dead donkey in the yard. And so he decided to call the police to come and remove it. But the man said, no, no, you have to call the health department. So the Maulana phoned the health department, and the man there said, sorry, you must call the sanitation department. So the Maulana, he called the sanitation department, and the man, they said, oh, no, 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 we cannot remove it unless you get the mayor's permission. Now, the Maulana was not very keen to call the mayor, because the mayor was a hot-headed character, very bad-tempered. He had a hell of a temper. But then he decided, you know what, you have to call him. So he took a very deep breath, and he called the mayor. And the mayor didn't disappoint at all. He was still in a bad mood. It was early in the morning. He was very irritated, and he said to the Maulana, hey, why are you calling me, eh? You are a Maulana. Isn't it your job to bury the dead? The Maulana very calmly replied, yes, Mr. Mayor, it is my job to bury the dead, but I always like to notify the next of kin.
Nice one. Khalili, Jazakumullah khair for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Pleasure, Maulana.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The next of kin, yes, most suitable reply to the mayor. It brings us on to 17 minutes to 9 on Sabah al-Muslim.
The Big Picture program was sponsored by Steering Auto Inspector Car in Benoni, the thinking person's car dealership. Steering Auto, the home of pre-loved cars.